Welcome to your custom tailor deep dive. We're jumping straight into a topic today that sits at the very foundation of the modern working world, even if it usually hides behind, mountains of dense compliance paperwork. We're looking at a federal document that outlines the tax and labor laws regarding how businesses classify the people who work for them.
Right.
And whether you're scaling a startup, maybe navigating a series of freelance contracts, or just trying to understand the invisible architecture of the economy around you, this is the blueprint. We are examining the incredibly treacherous legal distinction between an independent contractor and an employee.
It is a massive dividing line. I mean, grasping the mechanics of this specific document is really the ultimate shortcut to understanding business economics and labor rights in the United States.
Yeah.
This single classification, it dictates the daily operational friction of business, and it completely defines the legal protections a worker is entitled to receive.
Exactly. Mm. And our mission today is to take these rigid federal checklists and translate them into a practical framework for you. We're going to bypass the legal jargon and examine how these rules actually apply to the workforce you interact with every day.
Because it's not just about what title is printed on a contract.
Right. It's about evaluating the actual lived reality of the working relationship.
And the stakes outlined in the source material are substantial. Classifying a worker is a strict legal compliance issue governed by, overlapping spheres of tax law and labor law. Getting this wrong exposes a business to severe financial liabilities.
Huge liabilities.
Yeah, and it fundamentally alters the economic reality of the worker.
Okay, let's unpack this. Why is there so much tension around this specific classification? I mean, if we look at the requirements for having an official employee, the sheer weight of the employer's burden becomes obvious very quickly.
It really does. We can start with the tax law requirements detailed in the text. When a business classifies a worker as an employee, federal law triggers an immediate series of mandatory financial obligations.
That withholding stuff.
Exactly. The business is legally required to withhold income taxes directly from that employee's paycheck. They must also withhold and pay Social Security and Medicare taxes.
Right.
And beyond that, the business is on the hook to pay unemployment taxes based on the wages paid to those employees.
That introduces a heavy layer of administrative overhead before we even talk about the direct financial cost to the business.
Oh, absolutely.
And those are just the tax requirements. The source then stacks the labor law requirements right on top of that. Under federal labor laws, businesses are generally required to pay their employees a minimum wage, and they must pay overtime premiums for any hours worked over 40 in a single work week.
Then we hit the crucial contrast in the document. It explicitly notes that businesses are generally not required to comply with any of these tax or labor requirements for their independent contractors.
None of it.
Yeah.
No income tax withholding, no unemployment taxes, no federal minimum wage guarantees, and no overtime pay. The financial incentive for a business to classify a worker as an independent contractor is just massive. It removes so much friction and cost from the balance sheet.
It does, but, and this is a big but, a business cannot simply declare someone a contractor to save money. The federal government uses very specific lenses to evaluate the true nature of the relationship.
Right. They're not just going to take your word for it.
What's fascinating here is that federal tax law, which is governed by the IRS, evaluates this relationship almost entirely through the lens of control.
Control.
Yes. The source states that to determine the proper classification, you must weigh all information providing evidence of the degree of control and independence in the relationship.
The degree of control and independence. The document breaks this abstract concept down into three specific categories of facts. Let's look at the first one, which is behavioral facts.
Mm-hmm.
The text defines this as the business's control over what the worker does and how they do their job. But let's test that. If I hire a highly specialized senior software developer to build an app, I am definitely not telling them how to code.
Right.
I wouldn't even know where to start. I just need the app functioning by Q3.
Mm-hmm.
Does that automatically make them a contractor?
Not automatically, but that lack of behavioral control strongly points in that direction. The IRS is looking at the right to direct the means and methods of the work.
The means and methods.
Yeah. If you are dictating their daily schedule, micromanaging the specific steps they take, and requiring them to use your specific coding frameworks, you are controlling the behavioral facts.
Got it.
But if you only care about the final result and leave the process entirely up to their professional discretion, they are operating with the independence of a contractor.
That leads to the second category, financial facts. This looks past the daily tasks and examines the business aspects of the job.
Right.
The source points specifically to who provides the tools and supplies and whether expenses are reimbursed. But what happens when the lines blur?
They blur a lot these days.
Say a company requires me to use their highly secure proprietary software to access their network, but I am installing it on my own personal laptop that I bought. Who is controlling the financial reality of the tools in that scenario?
That is exactly where the friction lies in modern work and why it's a balancing act. The company is dictating the software, but you took on the financial risk of purchasing the hardware.
Right.
However, the document also highlights expense reimbursement. If that same company is paying for your home internet connection and reimbursing you for your travel to their headquarters, those financial facts start stacking up on the employee side of the ledger.
Because a true contractor pays for their own overhead.
Exactly. An independent contractor generally absorbs those operational costs as part of running their own business.
They are managing their own profit margins. Then we have the third category, which is type of relationship facts. The document lists written contracts and employee benefits here. Obviously, offering someone a 401k or a health insurance plan is a massive indicator of an employee relationship. But regarding contracts, calling someone an independent contractor on paper doesn't magically override the reality of the situation, does it?
It absolutely does not. The contract is just one piece of evidence regarding how the parties intended to structure the relationship.
Interesting.
If the written agreement says independent contractor, but the behavioral facts show you dictating their every move, and the financial facts show you providing all their equipment, the IRS will look right past that contract.
Wow.
The document explicitly states that businesses must weigh all three of these categories together, and that there is no set number of facts that automatically determines the classification.
So it's not a simple math equation. You cannot just check 4 boxes out of 10 and declare victory.
No, you can't.
You have to evaluate the entire relationship, the overall extent of the right to direct and control, and then document every single fact used in making that determination.
And that documentation is critical because if an audit happens, the business must show its work and defend its reasoning based on those behavioral, financial, and relationship facts.
Here's where it gets really interesting. What happens when a business meticulously weighs all of these facts, looks at the control, looks at the finances, and the situation is still entirely ambiguous?
It happens more often than you'd think.
Well, the source document actually contains a fail-safe. If it is completely unclear, a business can file Form SS-8 with the IRS to receive an official binding determination of the worker's classification.
Filing Form SS-8 effectively hands the facts over to the federal government, asking them to make the final call for tax purposes.
But think about the reality of doing that. If a business invites the IRS to deeply scrutinize the classification of one worker, they are essentially putting a massive spotlight on their entire operational structure.
It's definitely opening a door you might not want to open.
Right. It is an escape hatch for a confused employer, certainly, but one that comes with a high level of federal scrutiny.
It is a calculated risk. Now, everything we have just analyzed regarding behavioral and financial control is strictly for tax law, but the source document does not stop there.
Right, because there's a whole other half to this.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, federal labor law introduces a completely different framework. Under the Fair Labor Standards Act, or FLSA, the legal standard shifts away from the strict control test of the IRS.
So it's not about control anymore?
Not primarily. We enter a framework defined by economic reality.
Economic reality. Okay.
Yeah.
The text defines an employee under the FLSA as someone who, as a matter of economic reality, follows the usual path of an employee and is fundamentally dependent on the business which he or she serves.
That concept of economic dependence is the engine of labor law.
Are they genuinely in business for themselves, or are they dependent on the principal business for their economic survival?
Exactly. And to determine this economic reality, the U.S. Department of Labor relies on 7 traditional factors. There is no single rule, so we really need to put these factors under the microscope to see how they actually function.
Let's do it. The first factor is the extent to which the services rendered are an integral part of the principal's business.
Consider the core function of the business. If a magazine hires a freelance plumber to fix a leak in their office, plumbing is not integral to the business of publishing.
No, not at all.
The plumber is clearly an independent entity. But if that same magazine hires a freelance writer to produce weekly cover stories, Writing is the lifeblood of their product.
That makes perfect sense.
The writer's service is absolutely integral to the principal's business, which strongly suggests they are following the usual path of an employee.
The closer you get to the core product, the harder it is to claim independence.
Precisely.
Okay, the second factor evaluates the permanency of the relationship. We understand that a short-term, finite project looks like contractor work, but the permanency factor is tricky in the modern economy.
Very tricky.
What about a freelance consultant who has been on a rolling month-to-month retainer with the same client for 5 years? At what point does an ongoing contractor bleed into a permanent employee in the eyes of the Department of Labor?
That is a highly litigated gray area. Even if the contract is technically month-to-month, a multi-year, uninterrupted relationship creates a heavy reliance.
They're essentially acting like an employee.
The economic reality is that the worker has become a permanent fixture in that company's ecosystem. The Department of Labor looks at the practical reality of the tenure, not just the technical renewal terms of the contract.
Which brings us to the third factor, the amount of the alleged contractor's investment in facilities and equipment.
Right.
We touched on tools with the IRS test, but the DOL frames this around significant investment. Let's compare a freelance graphic designer buying a $3,000 MacBook to a freelance construction worker buying a $100,000 backhoe.
It's a very different scale.
Does a laptop truly count as a significant investment in facilities and equipment under this historical standard?
It is about the relative nature of the investment required to perform the service independently. The backhoe is a massive capital expenditure that clearly signals an independent business operation.
Right. Nobody buys a backhoe casually.
Exactly. A laptop, while expensive, is a ubiquitous consumer good. If the only investment a worker makes is purchasing a standard computer, the Department of Labor often views that as insufficient to establish true economic independence.
Especially when you compare it to the company they are working for.
Yes. Especially when compared to the massive infrastructure investments made by the principal company.
That makes the barrier to proving true independence quite high for knowledge workers. The fourth factor is the nature and degree of control by the principal. We see the overlap with the IRS here, but how does the DOL evaluate control differently?
While the IRS looks at control to determine tax liability, the DOL looks at control as a mechanism that creates economic dependence.
Ah, dependence again.
If a business dictates your schedule, forbids you from working for competitors, and subjects you to disciplinary policies, they're exerting a level of control that prevents you from operating as a truly independent economic actor.
Because you literally don't have the time or freedom to grow your own business.
Exactly. You cannot grow your own business if another entity controls your time and methods so tightly.
That directly impacts the fifth factor, which is one of the most revealing. The alleged contractor's opportunities for profit and loss.
That's a big word.
An employee generally has a reliable stream of income. They might not get a bonus, but they aren't going to lose money going to work.
Exactly. An independent contractor, however, operates with entrepreneurial risk.
Real risk.
Yes. If an independent contractor bids a fixed price of $10,000 to build a website, and it takes them 3 months longer than expected because of their own inefficiencies, they absorb that financial loss.
Ouch.
But conversely, if they finish it in 2 weeks through sheer skill, they drastically increase their profit margin.
So they have leverage.
Right. If a worker is paid a flat hourly rate indefinitely with no opportunity to increase profits through management skills and no risk of taking a loss on a project, they lack the economic reality of a contractor.
They are totally insulated from the market.
Mm.
Which ties perfectly into the sixth factor. The amount of initiative, judgment, or foresight in open market competition with others required for the success of the claimed contractor.
It's a long title, but it's crucial.
This goes beyond just being good at your job.
It asks whether the worker is actively hustling in the open market. Are they running marketing campaigns? Are they actively bidding against competitors for new clients?
Are they acting like a business?
Are they exercising business judgment to diversify their client base? If a worker is simply receiving a steady stream of assignments from a single platform or company and completing them without any need for independent business foresight, they are not competing in the open market.
They are essentially waiting for the boss to hand them a file.
Precisely.
Finally, the seventh factor evaluates the degree of independent business organization and operation. This seems to be the ultimate test of legitimacy.
It is the structural proof. Does the worker operate under an LLC? Do they have a dedicated business bank account? independent insurance, their own branding, and a distinct business address.
Or is their entire professional existence completely subsumed within the principal's internal operations?
Exactly. And when you synthesize all seven of these factors...
Now, integral to services, the permanency, the capital investment...
The control, the risk of profit and loss, the open market competition, and their independent organization, the Department of Labor arrives at the true economic reality.
And the source states that if the evaluation of these factors determines that an employer-employee relationship exists, the federal laws regarding employee pay lock into place.
Instantly.
The business is instantly liable for minimum wage and overtime requirements, regardless of what the initial contract stated.
That's the power of the FLSA.
So we have navigated the strict control framework of the IRS and the deep economic reality framework of the FLSA. But the document includes one final critical detail buried in the fine print at the very bottom of the page.
It's easy to miss.
It states, additional requirements may apply under state law.
That single sentence fundamentally changes the compliance landscape. Everything we have discussed today regarding the IRS, Form SS-8, and the seven FLSA factors represents the federal baseline.
Just the baseline.
It is the national minimum standard.
So even if a business meticulously follows the federal guidelines, carefully balances the behavioral and financial facts, correctly assesses the economic reality, and confidently classifies a worker as an independent contractor, they are still not entirely in the clear.
Not at all. State laws can be completely different, and in many jurisdictions, they utilize entirely different legal tests that are far stricter than the federal standards.
So you really have to do your homework locally.
The document's explicit advice is that to achieve full legal compliance, you must contact your specific state's tax or labor department. Navigating the federal document is mandatory, but it only solves half the equation.
So what does this all mean? For you, it means recognizing that classifying a worker is not an administrative afterthought. It is a highly complex legal balancing act.
It really is.
You have to weigh behavioral control against financial realities. You have to evaluate a worker's entrepreneurial risk against their economic dependence on a single entity. You now have the actual federal framework to understand the invisible forces shaping the modern workforce, from freelance platforms to traditional corporate offices.
This raises an important question. As we analyze the Department of Labor's seven factors, it is clear they rely heavily on evaluating physical, traditional elements of work.
Like the backhoe.
Right. The standard looks for investment in physical facilities and heavy equipment. It searches for the permanency of a relationship that follows a traditional, usual path.
It is a framework built for factories, construction sites, and traditional offices.
But if the very definition of an employee under labor law depends on following this usual path, what happens when technology fundamentally dismantles the nature of work?
That's the big unknown.
What happens to this historical framework when physical facilities are no longer required because the office is entirely virtual? When the only necessary equipment is a cloud subscription? And when the permanency of a career disappears into a decentralized gig economy?
It's all up in the air now.
Will this physical-based framework eventually break under the weight of modern digital innovation? It is a tension that will define the future of labor.
A fascinating structural dilemma to leave you with. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the hidden rules that govern the working world. Keep examining the structures around you, and we will be here to decode the next set of rules with you.